My Mac Podcast 133, WWDC is over, and the big news?
And we've got our guest co-host, David Biedney.
The next generation of radio, it's the MyMac.com Podcast.
And after a week's hiatus, Chad Perry, myself, Tim Robertson, and Guy Searle is back. We took a week off.
Yeah.
And I'll get into why in a little bit.
And we picked somebody up, too.
That's right. So how you doing, Guy?
I'm doing okay.
Now, you're not going to be here for the next two shows, right?
Nope. Going on down to Florida. Spend some time at the Disney World and have some fun down there.
And joining us from New York is David. Hi, David.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. Who the hell are you?
I found a microphone, and I started talking into it. You guys showed up. I was going to ask you the same thing.
We set up this remote location at this gas station in New York. David was the only person we can get to actually step up to the microphone.
I like unleaded. I like it. That unleaded gasoline never went down right. It didn't. It always messed up my CPU. And now I'm running at 25 mega chickens.
Mega chickens.
Yeah, mega chickens.
I love it.
They don't hurt as much, but boom, boom.
So, last week we weren't here,
and yep. WWDC was last week.
Yeah, and well, was technically the week that we're recording this.
Yeah.
But let's go a little bit into David first, then we'll get into all the big Mac announcements or lack thereof.
Absolutely. Well, David's been around for quite a while.
Yeah. And around and around.
Is that him over there? No, he's over there now.
Actually, you used to have your own podcast. You used to have the, what was that?
Oh, you're going to hit me with this now.
Yeah, it was the...
had Attention Photoshoppers.
Attention Photoshoppers podcast, yeah.
It's probably going to come back from the dead.
So I guess it's just in hiatus at the moment.
Yeah, you know, I got sort of distracted with other things and
making a living.
Well, yeah, there's that. Like that's possible doing a podcast. No, but you know, it's hard to do a podcast by yourself. We're just talking because you know it's just never a good thing. So.
Hello, Tim. Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like so. I think I found a good co-host, and there were distractions with other podcasting projects that are so weird I won't even bring them up, but I actually have
thrive on weird.
Oh no, dude, you have no idea. You type my name to a search engine, you'll come up with a strange podcast thing that I do that actually has gained quite a bit of attention in a completely different world than technology, and has messed with my career. But that's, we're going to talk about Mac stuff today, right?
Speaking of Mac stuff, yeah, you've been around for a long time writing for Mac User, Macintosh Today, Mac World, New Media. I mean, you've been even a Windows thing, which we won't hold against you.
Sometimes there's good stuff under that operating system. There's never been a 3D Studio Max for the Mac. Sorry.
No. Nope.
You know, for whatever reasons. But yeah, actually, my involvement goes back to 1984, and actually preceding that with the Apple II back to the, I guess, late 70s. I've been doing this for far too long. Far too long. I know where a lot of the skeletons are buried and where they're cased in cement. So.
So you also worked for, as a consulting client for LucasArts Entertainment.
Well, I used to work in Industrial Light and Magic.
I know. I was saving that for later. That was the big finale.
Oh, I'm sorry. I went and screwed that up.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
Let's talk about ILM. A lot of Mac users obviously work at ILM. How big was the Mac influence at ILM back in the day?
I was there in 1991, and the digital effects department, the department that does two-dimensional graphics and compositing, was essentially entirely Mac-based, and that was a bit of a unique thing there. And ultimately, that department blew away the optical's compositing department and the optical scanning and printing, and all of that ended up going away. And the Mac played a very important role there and still does. A big part of that is a fellow by the name of John Knoll, who anybody who uses Photoshop will recognize that name, and anybody who's into Star Wars will recognize that name. But John was responsible for bringing me to ILM back in 1991, and he was a huge advocate of the Mac there. And he's probably single-handedly responsible for getting a lot of people there interested in the Mac. And another guy, Dennis Murin, who is probably the leading special effects artist, supervisor in the world, and has won, I think, more Oscars than anybody else in the world.
Wow.
He, you know, type his name into a search engine and stand back. Dennis was a huge Mac advocate and fan. And between Dennis and John, they really pushed the use of the Mac there. And, you know, ILM is the kind of place where whatever the tool was, if it was a good tool, they would use it. You know, brand loyalty was not something that was the top priority there. And, you know, the Mac has always been, for the most part, a superior solution. And so they used it quite heavily. And I got hired there because of my early involvement with Photoshop as well. It was a really interesting time working there, and probably from what I've heard people say, the very end of when it was really fun to be there. It kind of went downhill after the early 90s, and now it's a completely different beast. I would not want to work there now.
Well, yeah, you'd
what
have to answer
happened?
To... Well, I would say the prequels, but...
Oh, jeez. I mean,
spooky.
Yeah, Anakin Skywalker. Well, the prequels were part of it. Actually, the last movie I worked on at ILM was Hook, which I like to call Steven Spielberg's first dinosaur movie.
Yeah.
it was kind of a bit of a disastrous production there, and I resigned after Hook. I couldn't handle the 110-hour weeks and sleeping under my desk. It was just, like, too much.
It's a young man's game.
Well, very much so. Very much so.
Right. I talked about that on the last show, that it seems like every time I see a group photo of Apple employees or when I'm at the Mac World Expo or what have you, it's always very young men. You don't see very many older people of my age or, I mean, we just can't pull those 120-hour work weeks anymore. We have families and interests.
That's a nice way of saying lives, but yeah, absolutely. You know, it seems like that's certainly the deal with the visual effects world. High tech has really become that, certainly in the gaming industry.
Yeah.
Most of the people who work that, if you're still doing work in the trenches in your late 30s, you're doing something wrong. You know, people either get up into upper management or cash out. They bail out.
Mm-hmm.
Not that anybody really cashed out at ILM. It's not that kind of a business. You know, people who work there really do it because they love it. And I think, like anything else, once you spend enough time in a situation like that, you kind of figure out what it is and what it isn't. And if you want to have a life doing visual effects work, I mean, I'll give you a great example of this, and this will be a kind of a cute inside thing for your audience. There's that new Pirates of the Caribbean movie, and God knows, I don't even know the name of it because I think those movies are just terrible. But there's a scene towards the end where there are all these crabs coming down at people. I guess there's some female character, and she lets her hair down or something, and all of these crabs come running out and overrun people. And I've kept friends at ILM over the years, and I've always had my ear.
That's not usually where the crabs are, is it?
Oh, jeez.
I had to go there.
So, oh, man.
I had to go there.
That hurts.
Yeah, well, that's I've heard it does. I couldn't speak to that directly.
Oh, no.
We need a bada boom.
A title for the show, Crabs, They Hurt.
Oh, well, check it out. I mean, so I saw a bunch of the footage associated with this effect sequence, and the way they did it was they had, I think it was either 15 or 20,000 blue tennis balls being dropped from this big, huge set of containers down onto the set and essentially, you know, just hitting the actors on the stage. I mean, I think the number was something like 15 or 20,000 tennis balls, these blue balls. There you go, if you really want to get them.
Yeah, here that's we go. Because of the crabs.
And, well, it gets better because essentially these each ball was supposed to ultimately end up being a CG crab. So God knows it was 1, 2, 3, 5 people who were given the mandate to now take this footage of, you know, and any given frame you'd probably be looking at maybe 1,000 of these balls or a couple of thousand of them, and your task is now to motion track each individual tennis ball.
Oh my God.
Which is like, if you think about it, is the equivalent of Chinese water torture. And you have to do this, and they had something like, a 4-month post-production schedule. So
wow, that's really fast turnaround.
Oh, it's just insane. And so, you know, you think about 40-year-old pair of eyes trying to track on a screen 8,000 blue tennis balls. That's torture.
Not going
to
happen.
No. That's for somebody who drinks way too much Jolt and has no life. I mean, that's
ILM is very similar to Apple in the early days in that a lot of the people that were both at Apple and ILM went on to create their own companies based on their experience and the contacts that they made at their previous jobs. So, I mean, it's a pioneering company. I wouldn't want to work there, or Apple for that matter, but you do have to respect the history of these companies and what they've really brought, not just them, the company itself, but everything that they've spawned by the people who's quit and started their own companies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They were, both of those companies have served as incubators for a whole variety of ventures. And I think that's true throughout the high-tech world. You see that all over the place. A lot of the really cool software stuff that has come up over the years has been from small groups of people that are working at these big organizations and realize they have to strike out for themselves. I mean, that's how Adobe got started.
Right.
John Warnock and Chuck Geschke had been working at the Palo Alto Research Center. They had this page description language that no one at Xerox really knew what to do with it. So they went off and started Adobe, and they were smart enough to get into the pipeline with the original laser writer from Apple. And
well,
really,
they were the right company at the right time for Apple. I mean, that's what happened. The laser writer simply would not have worked had it been not for Adobe.
That's exactly correct. It was actually really, it was a triumvirate. It was the Macintosh and the LaserWriter. It was PostScript from Adobe, and PageMaker from Aldus.
Yes.
Those three things together arguably are the reason that we are here talking about Apple and the Mac today. If it had not been for that meeting of those three elements at that time in history, this is at a time when Apple's future was very uncertain. You know, there were a lot of problems. The Apple III had really been a complete
disaster.
Oh, just terrible.
But they were still selling just a ton of Apple IIs at the time. I mean, the Apple II, everybody wants to go back in history and think, well, then they came out with the Macintosh and it was wildly successful. Actually, no, it wasn't.
No,
it took a good 3 years before the Macintosh product actually started making money. They were carried by the Apple, not the Apple III, but the Apple II.
Sure.
Right up
sure.
to what, 89?
I don't have the data in front of me, but I think
91 was the last year for the Apple II with the 2GS.
Yeah, but it was profitable. It was the main revenue generator up through, I think, 89, and then
actually,
the Mac took over.
Yeah, no, the Apple IIGS really had its heyday like in 85 to 86 or 87. I remember when I was at the Mac user offices in New York, that was 1985. We had a 2GS that I was like the only one in the office that knew how to use it.
yeah.
And that was right around that time. So I'm going to guess it was like 88, 89 when the Apple II finally phased out. And I think people need to understand that, well, history, of course, is always rewritten by those who control the purse strings.
Right.
But, you know, the Apple II really was the computer that established the microcomputer industry, not
absolutely.
The IBM PC in 80? I want to say it was 81.
Yeah, 81, 82, right around in there. Yeah.
Yeah. The Apple II was really a platform, and it was all about the incredible variety of software that existed for that machine in pretty much in every market. You know, there was a great magazine at the time that I really miss called Soft Talk Apple. It was one of the best computer magazines ever. And this is when computer magazines were really thick and healthy, sort of unlike now, yeah. where the magazine industry has just been decimated. But back then, you know, Soft Talk Apple, you could open it up and see like a Cubicomp frame buffer box you'd hook up to an Apple II and to get these 3D shaded graphics that, you know, there was nothing on the PC that could even touch that. And there was a bunch of other stuff. I mean, when it gets down to software history, you know, people talk about Quark and Quark Express and how, ooh, you know, Express was their big product. And the reality is, no, actually, Quark had come to prominence with the Apple II with a word processing product called Word Juggler that was really important. And actually, I probably ended up installing hardware. He had to install a special card in the display adapter. You had to replace some of the keys on the keyboard. It was like a whole process. I probably installed a couple of hundred copies of Word Juggler on Apple IIs throughout New York City at the time. And that was Quark's first really big product. So they were around for a long time, and hopefully they'll be gone soon, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, I've never had a good working relationship with Quark. Their last version that came out, they really courted us, trying to get us to cover the new Quark Express, and you know, but by this point, though, I was just like, you know what? You guys have just kind of crapped on everyone for so long because you were the, you know, they were the toughest kid on the block when it came to desktop publishing. That's not the case anymore, and now they're all begging and groveling because they want to get back in the game. Well, maybe you should have thought about that before you treated the websites like crap, thinking that our opinion didn't matter and that nobody was reading us, because guess what?
forget about the websites, the way they treated their customers.
Oh, well, I've got a story on that, too. Yeah, it's just crazy how badly managed they were for a long, long time. And they may still be. I don't know.
Well, I think they're trying to mend their ways, but, you know, there's a thing called InDesign, and that's pretty much it now. Let's just mention one thing, though. The reason Quark Express was such a success was the third-party support for extensions, the equivalent of plugins, that really tailored the product to a whole variety of vertical markets. Catalog publishing was all based on Quark Express. And essentially what happened is that the same way they burned their customers, they ended up burning a lot of their developers. And those people ended up not coming back to the table to play with them. And then, of course, there's the incredibly funny and sad debacle of Quark Exposure, which was going to be their big competitor, Photoshop, that they were doing in conjunction with JVC. And, you know, then there's Fred Ebrahimi, who pissed off the Japanese and treated them like he treated his customers, and he completely blew that whole thing with JVC, and that product never came to market. And it's unfortunate, because at the time that it was announced, it had some technology that definitely got Adobe a little worried. But Ebrahimi and his crew completely, they just screwed that one up beyond any recognition.
Let's jump up to current news. WWDC just ended, and like a lot of people, I was expecting at least something. But, you know, just like the Macworld Expo, when the keynote was over at the Expo this year, there was nothing to go to the Apple Store to buy. When the WWDC keynote was over, and granted, this is for the developers, but still, there was nothing to go to the store and buy. Do you think Apple is kind of missing out here a little bit?
I think Apple has got their fingers in a lot of pies right now. I won't say they're stretching themselves thin. I don't think that's the case. But you could make an argument that they're sort of, well, I guess one could say they've never really paid appropriate attention to the IT market. There's that. There's the fact that they have a whole raft of applications out that seem to sometimes be hot and happening, and at other times, like right now, you look at Apple's Logic software, and there's been nothing done to it for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
They're throwing all this attention at the iPhone, which is cool, but at the same time, we don't see them following through on a bunch of other levels of their product line. So I think that maybe they are overextended a little bit, and I don't
just
know.
Trying to catch their breath, maybe?
Well,
yeah, but there's a lot of stale products at Apple right now. The iPod needs a refresher like you wouldn't believe. The iMacs need a refresher. I think aesthetically the MacBook Pros as well as the Towers all need something done. What's the newest product that Apple really has right now, other than the iPhone, which right now is still not out, well, is still the
Apple
MacBook.
TV. The Mac TV.
But even Steve has almost written that off. Yeah. Yeah. You heard him at the D conference where he said, well, it's a hobby thing.
Right.
Wow, really? It's a $300 hobby thing? I thought
$100 with a 160-gig drive.
Yeah.
But when you're worth, what's the guy worth? A couple of billion bucks? $300 is a hobby thing.
That's true.
And that's, I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Like, you look at what happened with Newton and John Sculley, where, you know, Sculley at the time was making, I don't know, like $100 million a year, and he felt that $1,200 for this glorified calculator was, you know, a decent deal. Well, sure, a guy who makes, how much money, when Sculley went to the bathroom, how much money did he make during that visit? That would be a couple of Newtons.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, that sometimes these guys need to get sort of a jab from the real world. And in the case of Steve Jobs, let's not forget, he's got this whole other thing called Pixar.
Yeah.
That's going on at the same time. So, you know, I mean, that guy's got one hell of a full day.
Well, Pixar is Disney now. So, I mean, I don't know how much he really has, because he doesn't own Pixar at this point.
He's the single largest individual shareholder, I believe, of Disney.
Of Disney.
Yeah.
Right. But 40%. Disney's such a big company, and they have so many properties that I honestly don't think Steve Jobs has a whole lot to do with them right now. Not really.
Well, if he wants to sleep, I don't see how he could.
No.
Yeah, true.
So many hours in a day.
That's right. So we got to see the great big hidden features in Leopard that Steve Jobs promised at the last WWDC that he wasn't going to reveal them right then because he doesn't want Microsoft to copy him before Vista comes out. We held our breath for an entire year, and we got Cover Flow in the Finder.
You got Stacks.
Wait a minute.
On Stacks.
What about the grassy desktop?
It's grassy now. Yeah, there you go.
That's right.
Don't get me wrong. I'm excited about Leopard. I really am.
And I am too.
But I didn't see anything new at this keynote that Apple showed off about Leopard that made me more excited. I was just as excited with everything else that I learned a year ago.
Yeah.
I still think it's going to be hugely successful. I think it's going to be a great operating system if it's not buggy.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really hard to get excited again about Leopard. It's like the second kiss from your girlfriend. You got the first kiss, and that was great, and the second one is nice, but it wasn't as nice as the first one.
Well, and the other thing is, I think when he was at the D conference and said that they had some other products in the works, I think people were expecting him to drop one of them at WWDC, and that didn't happen. So
Apple got a lot of press in the last couple of weeks, especially Steve Jobs. And really, we don't have anything new to show for it, except for Web 2.0 applications being supported on the iPhone. And I've talked to a few developers, and they were quite insulted by that.
Yeah.
Ajax is the way, right?
So right. Well, if it's so great, why isn't Apple developing their own applications to run the iPhone in a web browser? Because it's not that great. I thought that was... I don't know. I think that a lot of web developers are not going to be happy with Apple right now.
Mm.
I wouldn't be.
A lot of developers are always pissed off at Apple for one reason or another. I think they're kind of used to that. I think the other thing is that Apple stock is doing really well, and so maybe they don't feel the pressure to...
need something new.
Well, we live in a society that's so caught up on new stuff. I remember last time I finished my last Photoshop book, and I was showing it to an audience at the now-defunct Siebold seminars. The book had just come out, and somebody walked up to me and said, "What are you doing next?" And it's like, I'm relaxing.
Yeah.
Released a book, you know, like, when's the next one coming out? I don't know, man. I'm still trying. Yeah, I mean, we're a society that's so sort of addicted to the latest, greatest hook. When you look at the kinds of development efforts that go into these products, I mean, take any current piece of commercial software. I think for a lot of users, it's hard to appreciate the amount of incredible effort and work that goes into developing any application. Take your pick. That, you know, these things don't just grow on trees, and really talented programmers and developers are hard to find.
Yep.
You know, that this stuff works at all.
Well, and especially trying to come up with something new.
Right, exactly. But here's the thing, and when he said, "We have a new desktop," I thought to myself... I was watching the keynote after the fact, and I thought, you know,
Did he say a new desktop or did he say a new Finder?
I think he said it might have been a new desktop or a new Finder. I don't remember exactly. It might have been I think he said we have a new desktop.
Yeah, I think that's what he said too.
But here's the thing. So we're at a point in time where every Macintosh has the equivalent of deep graphics. Every Mac has 24-bit graphics, basically.
Yep.
I look at this and I think, where is the truly revolutionary new interface design? And let me tell you what I mean. You've got a desktop. You've got a screen that's 24-bit graphics, which means that you can do a really intense array of visual effects in that screen. What I haven't seen anybody do, and I was hoping Apple would take a lead in this, and I've been saying this for years now. I'm going to say it on your show. You've got the X and the Y dimensions of a screen. And, you know, yeah, you've got your 30-inch monitor. You've got a couple of those side by side. You've got plenty of real estate. But what about the Z axis? What about going into the screen? Especially on something like an iPhone where, you know, you've got a tiny little screen. I don't see software designers and interface efforts that take advantage of the fact that you've got this endless Z-axis, this deep well of space, this virtual space that exists on the desktop. I would love to see, you know, when I first heard the word spaces, I thought, oh my God, we're going to have this this desktop where you basically can zoom into the background and have, you know, you talk about like stacks of files. What about like a pile of files that's off in the background, that's stuff that I don't use as much, that I can sort of see, it's sort of dimmed, hanging out in the background. I can say, hey, go over there and let me take a look at those files and see what I need from over there and like zoom into that with the whole screen. That's the kind of stuff like that you would normally see in the realm of science fiction. But today we have the hardware support to make that kind of stuff happen. And with core animation, you'd think that would be effortless. So what I didn't see at any part of what he did at the WWDC was to show that true next generation of stuff. I mean, he was showing semi-translucent menus. What, are you kidding me?
Yeah, I had that back in Mac OS 8 with a few shareware programs.
Right.
I mean, I just wasn't impressed with almost any of the things that they... Nothing jumped out and grabbed me. I really wanted to be wowed, and weren't.
Well, and that's it. I think when I've looked over what they've given on the previews and the WWDC stuff, it's a lot of nice to haves, you know. Right. But nothing
that grabs you.
Exactly.
Right. Well, last year, you know, we were introduced to Time Machine, which is a great idea.
Right.
But again, it's a backup. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been running Retrospect for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Spaces, yeah. Which they've had third party doing that for a number of years now. Stylized mail, and you're in mail now, which is, it sounds great until your uncle gets a hold of it and thinks that, you know, 24-point comic font sans looks great, and, you know, oh, God.
But you like that, Tim? How'd you like that email? Right.
Huh? It comes out kanji on yours.
Yeah, exactly.
I gotta flip this around, because it's important to remember that I think that all of us that are here on this show right now are seasoned Mac users, and I think at this point, Apple knows that we're going to buy their machines. They've got us already.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of what's going on is to wow the PC people that are, you know, going into the Apple stores, they're buying the iPods, they're going to soon maybe be running Safari. This is all about getting them to come over, and you know, they don't have very high expectations because they've been using Windows for years.
That's true.
So, yeah. I think it's really important, you know, when we talk about this stuff, to have that sort of larger meta perspective in that, you know, those of us who are Mac heads, we've always been Mac heads. We're not about to switch over to Windows. That's not really going to happen. Though, I mean, I'm saying this with my, you know, G5 machine on one side and a Dell box sitting on the other side of me. I mean, I find it useful to have both platforms for any number of reasons, because ultimately, really, when it comes down to it, for me at least, it's computers are about applications. No, it's not even that. It's about the applications. The applications are what keep me really interested in the Macintosh platform. At the same time, there are some applications that are floating around on the Windows side that aren't on the Mac side. And in the end, when, you know, like if you're doing animation for a client or if you're creating multimedia, client doesn't care what you use. They just care about the end result.
Absolutely. Right?
You know, and I think so, you know, when you're a Mac head, it's easy to get kind of wrapped up in this, the whole cult of Mac. But I think if you step back, and this is where I think it's good to have a historical perspective of how this industry came about and where it really came from, I think you realize at a certain point, all right, a box is a box is a box. The Mac OS to me has always been preferable to Windows. But really, when it comes down to it, it's about the apps, man. That's really why people buy computers.
You know, and if we go back and look at Mac OS 10.0, when it first came out in beta, and then you look at what Leopard's going to offer us in just a couple more months, there's been huge leaps and bounds that we almost take for granted at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Mac users do take for granted, and I think that's the important part. You know, people want to be wowed with every release, and at this point, you know, we have to remember when it comes right down to it, Apple is a business. They're going to do what makes business sense. They're not a religion. I mean,
I've listened to a couple other podcasts this week, and I've been all over the Mac web, and I found it very interesting reading all the theories about why Apple released Safari. Mm-hmm. For the PC, when I thought it was obvious to me as soon as I read it, I knew exactly why they did it. At least I feel that. I think that's why. Some people said, "Oh, so they can make more money via Google searches." I don't think that's it. No. I think it's something very, very simple. How many times have you been on your Mac and you've gone to a website that says it's not compatible with your web browser?
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, "Crap!" So then you go as a Mac user, we go fire up Firefox, and then we use that website.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, what's about to come out? The iPhone. Yeah. What's the browser? Safari. And you can't install another web browser on there, can you? You're stuck with Safari. You can't go download Firefox. You can't download anything on the iPhone, correct?
Absolutely.
So Apple releases Safari to the Windows platform. Why? Bigger market share. Why? So it's more supported. Mm-hmm. So they can sell those $600 cell phones that has Safari built in. To me, that's exactly why they did it. Why else would you do it?
I think that's it. I think you hit it on the head there.
They want more compatibility on the web with Safari. Even though technically, if you look at the specs, Safari is more web compliant than any other web application or web browser. But yet so many websites use goofy, you know, Microsoft
proprietary technology.
Right. And Apple
else.
Right. You go to these online banking systems that you can't use it because you're in Safari. Mm-hmm. And I think Apple, if they can increase the market share of Safari, is going to force those companies to make their websites more compliant with Safari. And that's only going to help Apple as far as the iPhone goes. So I think that's why. I think it's pretty simple.
I think that's exactly accurate. And I think also we're going to see a trend over the next few years of more and more Apple-centric applications popping up under Windows. I think part of it is an issue of perception and mental market share. Plus, I think at the end of the day, you know, regardless of the fact that Gates and Jobs were buddy-buddy at that little conference thing they had, I think Jobs has a certain perverse pleasure sort of pushing Gates' buttons.
That's really true.
I mean, you know, and how does Gates hit back? Look, it's the Surface.
Yeah.
$10,000 touchscreen computer. That's a coffee table. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if Steve can do it, I can do it better. No, you can't.
Well, you know, you got two guys. One's worth, you know, $40, $50 billion. The other's worth a couple of billion dollars. I think they get a certain perverse pleasure out of this, both of them, because let's face it, if it weren't for these two guys, the high-tech industry would be a lot less interesting, certainly a lot less entertaining.
After Bill Gates retires from Microsoft in another year from now, do you think we might see a departure of Steve Jobs shortly thereafter? I mean, because then Gates is gone from Microsoft. What's his big rival at that point? Is it Microsoft the company?
No. Steve Jobs...
I think he'll be there till he dies.
I think so.
Well, I know we all hope so, but let's be honest.
But personality-wise, I don't think Gates is anybody that has ever needed to pull a lot of attention to himself.
Yeah, I think Jobs does.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Are you saying that Steve Jobs has a big ego?
You can tell when he gets up there. When he gets up on stage and and does the keynote. He's
Rockstar.
He is really enjoying himself. I don't think it's just about ego. I think he really, really enjoys himself when he does it. Mm-hmm. He likes the attention, sure. But just like a stand-up comedian, you ask a stand-up comedian, would you, if you could get a bigger laugh out of people in a completely darkened room, or less laughs, but they could see you, they would prefer a completely darkened room because they're going for the laugh,
mm-hmm.
not yeah. to look at me, unless you're like Gallagher, then you know,
no,
that really wouldn't work.
Wait a minute. The thing about the big secret to know about any and every professional comedian is that they're all deeply insecure people.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't know that I would put Steve Jobs into that category.
You don't think so? I think maybe he is somewhat insecure, and that's kind of why his personality is what it is, because he's trying to convince everybody else that he's right. right. Exactly, because of an insecure.
What
we? We're like the Sopranos sitting on the couch, and we're going to psychoanalyze Steve Jobs now.
Yeah. Sometimes a mouse is just a mouse.
That's just a mouse. Let's probably move on from that. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to Leopard. I'm going to buy it the day it comes out. There's no question. Anybody here going to go line up to buy an iPhone next week? Or the week after next?
Where's that cricket noise again?
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, it's just too expensive.
Yep.
I'm already on a plan with a rival company. Come and get your love.
Don't say it.
Chad, take me off your list.
Yeah. Take me off your list, Chad. I want to look at the iPhone as it. Maybe if I lived in San Francisco where there's a Wi-Fi hotspot every 25 feet. But here in the wilds of Michigan, you know, what
I you got to go to Starbucks to find a hotspot.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that right, David?
Poor David would have to walk a good 20 feet to hit one.
That's anymore. Right.
I've actually had people down at the Starbucks trying to break into my Wi-Fi network. Good luck, boys. No. I mean, the thing about the iPhone, it's a cute toy, but I want something about three times bigger that runs real applications. You know, same basic thing. I want, you know, cool little wireless device with the touch screen, multi-touch, you know, interface. But you know, I have an admission to make here. I don't have a cell phone.
Wow, really?
You know, it's real simple. For
You're
me,
a hermit.
No, pretty far from it. No, it's not that. It's just that. I actually like having decent quality audio communications, and a cell phone is all about convenience, not quality. Cell phone, you know, audio quality for the most part is just freaking terrible. So you give me a cell phone that has really good audio quality and doesn't keep dropping calls, and that's the one I'll buy. You know, this whole idea of having this little device that, I mean, the only reason I think I'd buy an iPhone would be to have the really good web browsing abilities that it can apparently do. Who knows what it's really going to be?
Really going to be, right?
Well, exactly.
And the iPod functionality and the calendars and the contact list. That's why I would
frankly,
want it. If they would disable the phone features and just make it into an iPod, I would probably be out getting
it. The problem is it's not even that good as an iPod because it doesn't really have that much storage.
I mean, I have 120 gigs of music. I don't think that's going to be holding it. It's not going to happen.
Right.
So,
and you're losing almost a gig with the OS.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough in terms of functionality. It's not enough in terms of size. You know, I'm in my mid-40s, so I guess I'm almost a little bit out of the target demographic in that I want something with a bigger screen. I want to run real applications. You know, if I'm going to go spend $600 on something, though it's not really $600 by the time you're done with the service contract,
over
you know, you're, yeah, that's
yeah.
pretty far from an impulse purchase, I think, for most normal human beings. And so, yeah, there's just not enough functionality there. I do want a new iPod, but I think I'm going to wait to see what Apple does in terms of taking some of the technology that's in that iPhone and migrating it over to the iPod. I mean, I want an iPod where one whole side of it's the screen.
I think they have to do that now. Mm-hmm, I mean, after everyone sees the iPhone, I knew they were probably going to release a new iPod with that similar technology or form factor until after the iPod or iPhone comes out.
Exactly.
But I think we're probably going to see one come September,
Christmas.
Or maybe even before. I think they want to hit the back-to-school market. At the very least, they want to hit the Christmas market.
Well, that's what I'm holding on for.
Back to school
I mean, that's the deal
like,
I made with my wife. So.
Right.
Isn't the back-to-school market, like, right now?
They'd have to be announcing now and shipping in August.
Right.
But here's the flip side of that is, traditionally, Apple brings out new hardware. It's priced exactly what the current hardware is, and the current hardware goes down in price, and it becomes the mid or the low-end model, correct? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
How do you do that with the iPod? If you come out with an iPod that's functionally just like the cell phone, except it's not a telephone, it's just an iPod, are you really only going to charge $399 for that? Is that going to cannibalize the iPhone market?
Well,
I think it's a tricky thing that Apple's really got to be careful.
Yeah. Well, if I was going to guess when the next iPod would come out, I would guess that it won't be until the next Macworld. Because they're going to want about 6 months of exclusive iPhone sales and then make their decision then.
I don't think the iPhone sales is dependent on the holiday season at all.
I'm not saying holiday.
But Apple's not going. I do not see Apple passing up, missing this holiday season with a new iPod.
And they won't.
They have to capitalize.
They absolutely will. And you better believe that we're going to see a next generation iPod that will probably be a little bit more money because it will have, you know, the full size touch screen interface.
Yep. $499.
I think $499 to $599.
I don't think they're going to go quite $599. I think you're going to see the top end is going to be $499, and I don't think it's going to be hard drive. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be flash memory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
That's my prediction.
That much flash memory, if you're talking, you know, 16 to 32 gigs, that's still pretty pricey.
Huge.
Yeah, but Apple just ordered a billion pieces of flash memory from Samsung just like a month ago. And you know that's not off of the iPhone.
It depends
There's
how
no
many
way.
They sell.
Yeah.
Well, they bought it in, I think it was 256 chips or 512 chips.
Yeah. I mean,
and they're very tiny now, so I mean they can really pack a lot of those into an iPod.
Yeah, but
here's the thing, even if it's
worth. No,
and I don't think they're going to be able to come out with a new top of the line iPod, even if it is iPhone like, that has less capacity than the current top-of-the-line iPod. Right, exactly. I don't see that happening.
Right.
It depends on the functionality they put into it.
No, if you've got a 60-gig iPod, and you're starting to get used to putting movies, television shows, podcasts, as well as your music, you need more space. I mean, I'm at the point now where I literally have to, before I plug my iPod in to charge it, I have to go in and delete some of the podcasts and the video content that I download, because it's not going to fit at this point. And that's 60 gigabytes. I mean, if you'd have told me 5 years ago, when the iPod was pretty much just released, you're going to be filling up a 60-gig iPod here.
You wouldn't have believed it.
I'd have laughed. Oh. Yeah. And if you'd gone 10 years back, I'd have thought, you know, that's magic.
And there's nothing we haven't mentioned, the fact that now you've got the higher bitrate DRM-free music. All those files are a multiple of the size of 128K and 160K AAC. So, I mean, you know, the trend is definitely towards more storage, not less.
Yeah, listening to talking about it, I think you guys are both right. And I think one of the other things we talked about earlier in a couple podcasts ago was that if they do make this thing Wi-Fi enabled, you're going to see a lot more impulse buying off the iTunes music store.
Well, I think that's the next big step for the iPod, right, to be able to access not just an iPod-like control, but you will have iTunes, a simplified version, so it fits on a smaller screen and it'll look good. Mm-hmm. But an iTunes interface on your iPod, not the current iPod type of interface. It will be iTunes, and you will be able to access it, the actual iTunes music store, and purchase right then. So when you plug in your iPhone or your iPod to your computer,
kind of a dual
it syncs both ways. Yes. Well, it already does. And I made mention this a good 6 months ago, that when you plug in your iPod to another computer that's not yours, one of the things that gives you the option to do is to suck all your purchase tracks off your iPod, because it's assuming, well, maybe this is, your computer crashed and you want to get your purchase songs off your iTunes. So that functionality is already there to go from the iPod to the iTunes. And here's something else I don't know if anybody's even thought about yet. The big thing with the iPod when it first came out was the music was hidden on the hard drive, remember? All these little applications popped up on the internet, and a lot of them were quashed to make them visible, and you could pull stuff from the iPod back to the computer. Yeah. Well, if they're going to go with DRM-free music here soon,
it no longer matters.
Why do they have to hide the music? Mm-hmm. I don't think they need to. Thus, I think an iTunes interface on the iPod itself is entirely feasible. So I think you're right, Chad, though. It's going to be impulse buy. You're going to be sitting at a bus stop. Well, I doubt if you're going to be sitting on a bus stop if you can afford an iPod. But, you know, you're going to be sitting at the terminal at JFK. And I like that little song. I just heard, you know, the 10-second clip. Bye. Mm-hmm. Boom. It's on your iPod. You can listen to it all the time now.
But no squirting.
I think that's the future. No squirting.
That's right.
It's not the Zune. We're not squirting anybody with anything around here.
What's with the brown Zune? I like the brown Zune.
I will say, though, I did enjoy the WWDC opening where John Hodgman. Yeah, that was great.
Is that available on YouTube? I haven't been able to find that.
You can actually go up to Apple site and stream the entire keynote at this point, guy. I'm waiting for the... I haven't watched the whole thing yet. I'm waiting for Apple to offer it into iTunes so I can just download it and watch it at my leisure instead of streaming. I hate streaming video. I really do. If you're going to stream it, allow me to do a save as. I hate streaming video. What's the point? Well, we'll stream it so you can watch it, but we won't let you save it on your hard drive. Why?
I'm sure it's... if you poke around Apple's website, you're probably finding it somewhere.
I know. But I don't... why should I have to, though? I don't want to poke around. Give me a download. Download it now.
It's all about you, huh? I mean, sorry, it's all about Steve. In Steve World, it's all about Steve.
That's right. But this is the Tim podcast.
So. I see. I thought it was my Mac. What the heck?
Yeah. Speaking of, I didn't make a posting last week that we wouldn't have a show this week. And John Nemo sent an email like, oh, maybe you should put something up on the site. And I thought, no, nobody's going to care if we don't have a show this week. I got quite a few emails. I was genuinely surprised. Where is there no show this week? Are you just waiting to after WWDC or what's going on? A lot of people were really. They were looking forward to our speculation. But I'm like, well, the show would have came out Monday, the same day as Steve Jobs was going to reveal everything. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, what's the point? You're going to hear my speculation and go, oh, you got that one wrong.
You know? Well, that's part of the fun.
What
of the
an
show.
Idiot. New iPod, my ass. The real reason was I've got another project going that's not Mac related at all, and I thought I would share what that is. It's been pretty big news here in Battle Creek / Springfield.
Yeah.
Springfield is the key. I was contacted, 2 weeks ago now.
Yeah, just right at the end of May.
Right at the end of May. By the city of Springfield, Michigan,
suburb of Battle Creek,
and to come in and talk about a video project. That's all I knew. So I show up Friday and sit down, and it turns out they're in competition with all the other Springfields that are participating in the Springfield movie, the Simpsons movie contest.
Jeez, I thought it was going there. Oh.
Yeah, and the idea is they want me to do a 3 to 5 minute video for them. To win this competition, to get the premiere of the Simpsons movie in Springfield, Michigan.
Yeah.
And so when I first sat down and started talking about it with them, I thought, I really don't want to do a video by committee. You know, I don't want to come to a city commission meeting and have all their input and all that, you know. I was like, I told them, I said, you know, making a film doesn't work by committee, Hollywood notwithstanding.
Have you never heard of an executive producer? Are you kidding me?
That's and anything creative. And so I said, you know, I don't know. And he said, he being the city manager, he said, you'll have complete creative control. And it will just be you and me. That's it. Nobody else will be involved in making it.
And his wife.
I said, yeah, well, you know, have to have some recreation. Okay, we're going to do it. So we started batting around ideas. And he says, well, what do you think we should do? And I said, well, when's this due? And he said, we have to have it done by June 25th. And I went, go!
And by the way, Mr. Robinson, I won't have you marring the image of the fine people of Springfield.
So I said, well, how many other cities are competing in this? And he said, at least 16. And I said, oy. And we're probably one of the smallest Springfields competing. I figure most of the other ones are going to do putting up big banners in their city and filming that and having kids going, yay, eat my shorts, yay.
We're in Springfield spirit. Yeah.
Yes, you know, this really, really lame stuff like that. But 20th Century Fox sent out this full-size mock-up of the Simpsons living room couch with the actual Simpsons. This thing weighs like 700 pounds. It's huge. Just huge. I couldn't believe how big it is. And that has to be in the video.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the rules. And they sent props like Duff beer and, you know, stuff like that. It's they sent quite a few stuff, plus a video camera. In case you didn't have one, they sent a free video camera that Springfield gets to keep to videotape it on. And I looked at it and said, no, we'll use my Canon. But so the idea was, I didn't want to do something lame like I figured the other cities were doing, because all the other cities suck except for us.
As long as you're not overconfident, that's what counts.
That's right. So my idea was, because we've got such a limited amount of time to do it, is a mockumentary. And that's what I'm doing now. The mockumentary is based around Matt Groening comes through Springfield, Michigan in the early 80s, and that's where he got all the inspiration for the Simpsons cartoon, including the city and the characters. And the city of Springfield, Michigan are not happy about that. Awesome. And they want to refute those claims. Wow. So this mockumentary is taking the stance that this is not the Springfield of the Simpsons cartoon. And in fact, none of the characters in the city were ever the inspiration for these characters. Mm-hmm. But of course they were.
Yeah.
That's the funny part. So we have a Homer and a Marge and a comic book guy. And so I spent the last week and a half, 2 weeks writing the script, getting it edited and all that. I have a someone working with me. Her name's Cindy Goodenson. She's helping. I'm going to give her complete as much credit as I'm taking, because she's really stepped up, and I couldn't be doing all this without her. She's been a great partner in this. But that's what I've been doing, and that's what I'll be doing for the next 2 weeks until I drop dead of exhaustion and beg David to come help me finish this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's funny is, even right now, I haven't filmed 1 second of video yet. Not 1 second of this thing.
Pushing it, man.
You have to have a script before you can shoot anything. You got to know what to shoot first.
Really?
I've got some stuff. I've got, like, some signs.
Never stop,
you know,
George Lucas.
Crap like that.
Yeah,
I've already been.
Thank you.
Yeah,
for taking the time. That was it.
Yeah. That was it right there.
What script? Ewoks.
Ewoks attack.
Ewoks.
Hit them with a rock.
Jar Jar Binks.
These are clone troopers that were the ultimate fighting machine. They'll go down with a stick. Hit them.
That's right.
From a midget.
And they can't fire worth a damn.
No, they can never hit anything.
Man, closer to reality.
Including a pampered princess.
Please.
The pampered princess is just nailing them left and right, and they're like, oh, shit, we can't hit her. Anyways.
Just say the S on this broadcast.
Yeah, there goes the explicit tag.
Damn.
Yeah.
Well, hell, man.
In there somewhere.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's all wide open now, Dave.
All right. Now you're
so,
very end.
I've done 4 radio interviews at this point, a couple newspapers, and I've been on the evening television news 3 times now, and I haven't shot 1 thing. Mm-hmm. Well, there's no pressure there. It's crazy. If you Google Tim Robertson Simpsons, or no, Tim Robertson Springfield, it's like the first 5 pages of Google now. It's in Detroit Free Press and South Bend.
You set yourself up here, though. You gotta
yeah.
be careful.
Nah, let them. I don't care. If it sucks, it sucks. I don't care.
I'm sure they're listening to the show going, wait a minute,
you
care.
This video?
You care.
I do care, and it's been taking a lot of my time. And but the thing is, once I'm done with it, and it's sent off, and it will be posted up on the usatoday.com website, and I'll put a thing up at mymac.com, so any listeners or readers of the site can go up there and take a look at my masterpiece. And I'll be expecting the Emmy nomination any time.
Yep.
Yeah. Run those crickets again.
Yeah. So, David, what's in the future for you? What are you doing here in the next couple of weeks to the month? What's on your agenda? What are you going to be covering and talking about and doing? And
I'm actually working on a handful of reviews for MacLife and working on a feature for them as well. My editor today there said, you know, you find the most obscure, bizarre software. And that's something that's definitely a hobby of mine. I love finding stuff that, like, nobody knows about. And that's the thing about the Mac platform, that there are applications that only exist on the Mac that are a reason for having a Mac. And then there's stuff that is cross-platform. But, I mean, you know, like, one of the things I've been doing lately, I've been spending a lot of time in this program called Studio Artist by Synthetic Software, a Mac-only program that is just terrifying. Really, really cool stuff. And again, it's like the reason for having a Mac. And actually, another weird thing is that just today I found out, and it's just strange, this happens to be the serendipity of my life, but today I sold my very first piece of art.
Really?
Yeah. A guy wants to buy a digital painting I have sitting in a window in Hastings on Hudson, Westchester. And it, my buddy Clyde's hair salon. He's got this large format print of a strange piece of digital art I did. I just put in there for fun. And a guy just walked in and said, "I want to buy that. I love that thing. I got to buy that." And he calls me today saying, "You know, you just sold a piece of art." And I'm like, "Really? How much did I sell it for?" He's like, "I don't know. The guy's waiting to know." So I'm going to probably explore a bunch more of that kind of stuff.
One
and then
million
I do a
pops.
Well,
a billion dollars.
And then, of course, I have that crazy podcast that I do that's got nothing to do with computers that has quite the...
Would that be the Paracast?
Oh, yeah. Hell. He went and
yeah,
said,
well, I looked that up, too.
Yeah, there's a bunch
of... Hold his feet to the fire. Hold him.
Oh, God, you're burning me. Oh, my God, it's melting off my flesh. Oh, hell. Boil that dust speck. Just don't dip me any lower in the fire, please. I hate the smell of burning hair.
Please don't throw me in that boil patch.
Yeah, and then I think there's a trip to Argentina coming up momentarily here, so there's that, too.
Nice.
I like to go to Argentina in the winter.
Going to be at Macworld Expo next year? Say yes, so we'll hook up and have a good time.
Okay, yes, I will.
Some of the latest stuff up at the MyMac.com website. We have a review of Ubercaster from our own Guy Searle.
Mm-hmm.
So you like that podcasting application, do you, Guy?
Yes, I do. I like it very, very much.
We'll have to have you run a show one of these days on your end.
Maybe we'll ever get back to dung bowling.
Dung bowlers?
Dung bowling?
Yeah, that's something we're not proud of.
No, it's
intense.
Macspiration number 87, the browser image menus from Donnie Yanko, and then we have a review from Chad Perry.
Indeed.
Something that Chad doesn't do a whole lot of is product review, but there's one up there proving that you do a few.
Mind Manager 7
so you're one of the, that's one of the very first reviews of the new Mind Manager 7.
Oh, yeah.
Because David Cohen, whose Fenestration is coming up here after our segment.
Last month he did Mind Manager 6.
Yeah.
And, on his recommendation, I actually downloaded Mind Manager 6, the trial version, and was using it for some work-related things. And
Well, you're a Visio user, so you're very comfortable with Visio. So how do they compare? Do you like Mind Manager as much? Or?
Oh, I like Mind Manager more than Visio. Visio is more versatile because you have more templates and more things you can work with.
It's been out a lot longer.
I think, you know, for doing any sort of mind mapping... Or any sort of like visual organization, I think Mind Manager is just a lot slicker. It's a lot easier to use, and it's a lot less work.
Yeah, the pictures that you supplied for that review that's up there on the site made me kind of want to look at the program, too. It sounds that kind of looks intriguing. So make sure you take a look at Chad's review of Mind Manager 7 posted on 6-12-07. John Nemirovsky has a iSound Concert to Go review. It's a radio/iPod speaker system. He just rants and raves about it. He loved it. And no, he didn't rant. I guess that would just be raves, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Rant and rave would mean good and bad.
I can't see Nemo ranting about anything.
this is really, really cool. Russ Walkowicz did a review and an interview with Kevin O'Neill. Mm-hmm. And I hope you guys had a chance to read that. Mick O'Neill used to write for MyMac.com from the mid-90s, late 90s up through 2001. And, in fact, he was working on a review when he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were really bummed out. He wrote the Mac Factor column. He used to write it for PC Computing in Europe before, and then he moved over to MyMac, at the time, MyMac Magazine. We were online then, but... our focus was still the monthly PDF download of 100 pages. And so we were really bummed out to lose Mick. Mm-hmm. And I've stayed in somewhat contact with a few of his brothers and sisters over the years, but I get an email a couple months ago from Kevin O'Neill, who's Mick's son. Well, he's a programmer now. He's wrote some Mac and PC software, and the Imagine Poker is his software, and Russ took a look at it. I actually downloaded it and tried it. It was pretty fun. I'm not a huge poker player, but it was a lot of fun to me. I lost more than I won, but still, it's kind of hard to bluff a computer. They kind of know what you got. Yeah. But, you know, that's something that was kind of really neat for me. It felt like a member of our family coming back. You know what I mean? Mick's gone, and we really loved Mick, but here's a son, and it was great to be able to feature him on our site, knowing that, you know, the relationship between him and his father, and his father's what got him into computing, and specifically the Macintosh to begin with. So it's a special interview for us, and I hope everybody that's listening goes and takes a listen and or takes a look at it. Sometimes it gets a little confusing between listen and watch and look and
read, and
we're new media. We're everywhere.
You're consuming the media.
You talk a little. Watching. That's right. Guy Searle talks a little bit about Safari on Windows. What's that about, Guy?
Oh, basically, I've been kind of, you know, I don't have a Windows machine, so I wasn't able to actually use it, but just follow.
Oh, this is Safari, the web browser?
Yeah.
I thought you were, like, out hunting Windows.
Well, that's easy. Like, I've got a like bunch of them right here in the house.
Yeah. Yeah, you need a new Windows for your house. Oh, okay.
Cute.
Yeah. So we got David Cohen coming up with his fenestration segment, and we've got a special little promo we want to play. First, we want to thank David for joining us on the podcast this week. Thank you, David.
A lot of fun, guys.
Open invitation. Come back anytime you want.
Absolutely.
And chat with us and have some fun.
That sounds like very cool. I think I'll do that.
Everybody else, make sure you check out mymac.com for our latest reviews, opinions, and how-tos. And
general
we'll see
hijinks.
You guys. Yep. We'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Commander Sundance, executive producer of Division 360, an audio magazine created for the members of Team Special Forces, an online gaming community focusing on camaraderie and fun, and I'm very pleased you've joined us in listening to our friends here at the MyMac.com podcast. Hoo-yah!
Hello. My name is David Cohen, and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. Welcome to Fenestration number 32. There have been quite a few developments in Windows virtualization on the Mac over the last few weeks, what with WWDC and all, and so I'm going to spend today's segment talking about the developments. There's a bit of a functionality cold war going on at the moment between VMware and Parallels, the two developers of the principal virtualization solutions for the Macintosh. What's happening is that each developer is trying to outdo the other for features and market impact, and it's making for quite an interesting battle. First out of the box was Parallels. In the week before WWDC, they announced to all of their existing users that Parallels 3 would be launched imminently. Now, the version of Parallels that was available at the time was 2.5, so as a 3.0 release, Parallels were looking for users to pay a fee to upgrade. So it was important that they had the feature set right and to make people feel that they were really justifying the cost of that upgrade. There wasn't an awful lot of information beforehand about what will be in the upgrade, and contrary to Parallels' previous approach, a free beta was not made available to users. Anyway, the day before WWDC started, Parallels made the version 3 available to anybody who'd paid for a pre-upgrade price. The feature set is fairly comprehensive, I suppose. They've introduced 3D graphics support within the virtual session, which theoretically allows you to play games, and they've also improved the coherence mode that allows Windows applications to appear to be seamlessly part of your Macintosh desktop. The improvements in coherence are actually quite useful. What they do is they make each operating system's applications available to the other, transparently. So if you're in the Windows environment under Parallels and you go to the Start menu, you can actually see all of your Mac applications from the Windows Start menu, and can use those applications to open the files that host in the Windows environment, and vice versa. They've actually gone a little bit further than this as well, in that you can define that any particular document type can be opened by an application hosted either in the OS X environment or in the Windows environment. So, for instance, if you have Word documents on your machine and you always want to open them in the Windows version of Word 2007, say, then you can actually define that. And every time you click on a Word document, the Windows session for Parallels will open if it's not already open. The file will be transferred to the Windows session and will be open within the Windows version of Word. They've made this completely transparent, so when you've done that, if you then save the changes you've made in the Windows version of Word back to the file, the changes will be reflected in the Macintosh-hosted file, not within the Windows environment. So this effectively means you don't need to worry about whether you've got the copies of files in the right version, in the right place, on the Macintosh or Windows side. Parallels takes care of all of that for you. They've introduced snapshotting into this version of Parallels. Snapshotting is a technology where basically you take a virtual copy of the machine at the time that you hit the snapshot, and then you can resurrect that at any time. It's almost like doing a disk clone of the machine, but instead of doing a disk clone of the actual machine you're running, you're doing a disk clone of the Windows environment that's running under Parallels. As I mentioned previously, they've put DirectX 3D support into this version, so theoretically you can run Windows games under Parallels. Now, I'm not a big Windows gamer anymore. I used to be, but I switched to consoles some time ago. But I do have a couple of games that I do like to play every now and again under Windows, and they're hosted in the bootcamp environment on my MacBook. So I loaded these into Parallels and tried to run them up. Now, I've got to hold my hands up here. These games are quite old. I'm talking about the Command & Conquer 10th Anniversary Edition, and also Total Annihilation, another real-time strategy game. And I didn't find they were too successful under Parallels. Both games would actually load up and run, but I found the Command & Conquer not to work particularly well. There were quite a few graphical glitches, and Total Annihilation did run well, but only in 16 colours, which made it look really rather horrible. In both circumstances, when I went back to the Parallels environment, having run the games, and back to the Windows XP desktop, I found that the 16-bit colour had been lost and had gone purely to 16 colours. So I had to reboot the Parallels session in order to get my 32-bit desktop back. So there are a few glitches there. I'm sure these things can be sorted out, and I'm sure there are plenty of more modern games that work absolutely fine. For me, on a MacBook, I don't actually see an awful lot of value in being able to run games under Parallels. If I'm going to run games, I really want the maximum performance from the hardware, and I don't want to have to pay the performance price that Parallels imposes, even as small as it is. So if I want to play games on a Macintosh, an Intel Macintosh, I'm going to use Bootcamp to do that. But, you know, different people like different things, so it's nice that the support is there. And obviously the fact is that there are various other bits of software that require DirectX, but aren't necessarily 3D games. And of course those will now run under Parallels, where they might not have run before. Now, I mentioned before that Parallels 3 is a paid-for upgrade. I was offered a $40 upgrade price, though I believe that might be $49.99 now for existing users. And again, if you want to pay the full price, if you don't already own the software, then the price is $79.99. Do I feel that the features they've added to the 3.0 release are worth the $40? I'm a little bit undecided about that, to be honest. I certainly had a very workable environment with Parallels 2.5, and I would still definitely recommend the software if you don't have any sort of virtualization environment and you have an Intel Mac and a need to run Windows. If you currently have 2.5 and are wondering whether you should upgrade or not, well, you need to have a look at the feature list and see whether the thing's there. There's a few other minor features like USB improvements and that sort of thing. So have a look at those and see what you think. For me, I suppose it's nice to have, but I wasn't overly impressed in terms of it wasn't the quantum leap in functionality that we saw with earlier versions of Parallels. Obviously, they always continue to develop the product. They are very good at developing it quickly, so watch this space. However, there's an elephant in that particular room, and that elephant is VMware. VMware made a couple of announcements over the last couple of weeks. First of all, they announced version 4 of the beta for VMware Fusion, their competitor to the Parallels product. And VMware Fusion has most of the features that Parallels has. The snapshot feature that Parallels has just introduced is something that's always been with VMware. The 3D graphic support that Parallels have just introduced has always been with VMware. What VMware was lacking was the coherence mode, and they now have something similar called Unity that works in very much the same way that the Parallels version does. VMware also announced when they will finally be releasing their product as a live version and how much it will cost. It will be released in September of this year, and it will be priced exactly to compete with Parallels at exactly the same price of $79.99. This is going to be quite interesting. Parallels are the smaller company and have always been, appear to be, more nimble and rapid. They've certainly claimed the virtualization market for the Mac for themselves out of nowhere. The way they're structured is they have a head office and then a large number of Russian programmers who do all their work for them. However, of late, Parallels haven't been as responsive as they used to be. Maybe victims of their own success. They have quite an avid forum support up on their website, but I've noticed of late their developers don't really seem to be commenting or interacting with the users in that forum like they used to. Contrast that to VMware. Now, VMware are the big corporation. They've been in virtualization for a very long time. They're very well respected, and they've really got their act together in terms of what they're doing. This is the first time they've come to the Macintosh, and they really are bringing together a very impressive product. They've got a lot of experience, and it shows. The fact that they have much more operating system support than Parallels used to have, and the fact that the code and the software they tend to deliver seems to be pretty stable, pretty straightforward, not as functional as the Parallels products have been until recently. The thing is, despite the fact they're a very big company, the development team for Fusion are very vocal and are interacting directly with the users. So again, it's interesting how things have shifted there. Now, I've had a look at VMware Fusion, and it really seems to do the job. The only slight problem I have with it over Parallels at the moment is that obviously its performance isn't quite as good because it's running in beta. And secondly, I found that when I run it on my MacBook tends to warm up a fair bit more than it does under Parallels. I don't know why that might be, and it's not fair to judge the product properly at the moment because obviously it's still in beta. I'll reserve any further comments on that until the final version is shipped. Now, before the WWDC keynote, there was some speculation in the media that Apple were actually going to preempt both VMware and Parallels by introducing their own virtualization products into the next version of OS X, Leopard 10.5. Apple didn't do that, and in fact Steve Jobs made a point of hailing both Parallels and VMware in his keynote presentation. However, what may have slipped slightly under the radar, but was noticed by myself and a few others on the web, was the changes to Bootcamp that will come with 10.5 Leopard. Bootcamp will be included as default with 10.5 Leopard. It won't be a separate install. And also you will no longer need to use a generate a driver CD to load into your Windows session when you load it under Bootcamp. All of that will be built into the operating system. One thing that does actually make Bootcamp a fair bit more useful under 10.5 Leopard, though, is the fact that you can much more seamlessly switch between your Bootcamp and your OS X session. Effectively, anybody who's got a current Intel Mac knows that you can actually make it do what's known as a safe sleep. This is known as hibernate under Windows, and what the machine does in that situation is, rather than staying in the normal sleep mode where it's actually in a sleep but can spring to life at any moment, with all the memory still being retained electrically in the computer, what you do with a safe sleep is you actually write that memory out to disk and then shut the machine completely down. When you turn it back on again, it recognizes that the last thing it did was a safe sleep, it reloads those memory contents back into the memory of the computer, and it brings you back to where you were. The advantage of safe sleep is it doesn't consume any power because the machine is completely off. Now, what Apple are proposing to do in 10.5 Leopard is bring this technology to both Windows and OS X at the same time if you have Bootcamp installed. The way it will work is, rather than rebooting the machine completely if you want to switch between Windows and OS X, you will just initiate a restart, and what will happen is the machine will safe sleep whichever operating system you're in and bring the other one back from safe sleep. The upshot of this means that it should be substantially quicker and less painful to move between Bootcamp, Windows and OS X, and obviously you won't lose whatever's open or running at the time when you switch between one or the other. So, if you're in OS X and you have, say, iTunes and Mail.app open, and you decide you want to run a game in Windows, then you'll initiate your Bootcamp switch, OS X will be saved out to disk in a working state, and Windows will start, and you'll be able to play your game. When you're finished and you want to go back to OS X, you'll do your shutdown, and the Windows session will be safe sleeped, and the OS X session brought back from safe sleep and restored exactly where as it was, with your Mail.app and your iTunes open on the desktop as they were before you started. This is a substantial functional improvement over Bootcamp under OS X 10.4 Tiger, and it may be good enough to persuade some people who might be considering using virtualization software that in fact they don't have to bother. One final piece of cross-platform news from WWDC that's worth mentioning as an aside: there was a big announcement from Electronic Arts that they will be porting many of their current games and future developments to the Macintosh platform. In some of the further detail that arrived after the keynote, it became apparent that EA are doing this using something called Cider from a company called Transgaming. What Cider is effectively a gaming version of Rosetta that allows Windows games to be ported to the Mac by having code translated on the fly between Windows and Mac. It's an innovative technology that apparently really reduces the time it takes to port an application between Windows and Macintosh. Though it's worth mentioning that, as far as I'm aware, Transgaming's CIDR platform only works with Intel Macs. So there's a very good chance that these EA games that are coming in the summer that have been ported under this technology will only be available for Intel Macs and not for PowerPC Macs. This could be the first time that we start to see applications developed specifically for Intel Macs. And it's worth bearing in mind that the days of PowerPC are probably going to start to come to a close, especially once 10.5 Leopard is released. I say that with a slightly heavy heart, because I'm a big fan of the G4 PowerPC. I have plenty of Macs that still run on G4s or G5s, despite the fact that I enjoy the advantages the Intel platform brings to Macintosh with operability with Windows. Nevertheless, the PowerPC is where Macintoshes have come from. That's where we first saw OS X really come to the fore. So while I appreciate that all things must come to an end, I do hope their decline is dignified and graceful. That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.